From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. The winter of 2022 to 2023 had a lot of snow, which was great news for a lot of people. I remember it as being one of the best ski seasons of my life. But it was extra great news for the Colorado River Basin area. The snowpack in the upper Colorado River Basin contributes to 95% of the water that flows in the Colorado River. Snowfall in that area provides water for two of the largest reservoirs in the country and for tens of millions of people. So that snowfall is important. And traditionally, scientists have been able to predict what that snowfall will look like. Predictive signals in the Pacific, El Niño and La Niña patterns, can usually clue them in. But what about in extreme cases with unexpected snowpacks, such as the one we saw in the winter of 2022? Can those incidents be predicted by specific patterns in the tropical Pacific? Matthew LaPlante wondered just that, and according to his team's recently published research, the answer is no. That winter was what's called stochastic, meaning it appears to have been randomly produced as a result of conditions that cannot be predicted. And this means that random factors play a big role in how much water we have. Matthew LaPlante is the Undisciplined host that you know and love. He's also an author, a journalist, a climate scientist, and an associate professor of journalistic writing at Utah State University. Matthew LaPlante, welcome.
This is really weird being on this side of the microphone.
I was going to ask, how does it feel to be on the other side of this?
when we started talking about this, I thought, okay, this is a good idea, right? Like, and I'm very excited to talk about my work as a scientist, not just to interview other scientists, but I'm scared right now. I'm legit a little shaky in my chair.
You don't know what to expect.
This is how my guests always feel, I guess.
So, Matthew, your listeners know you first and foremost as a radio host, not as a scientist. So I'm sure it's really exciting for them as well to hear this role reversal. And something that's so interesting to me is how you found the pathway to being a scientist, because you wrote in a piece that science almost caused you to drop out of high school, not because you weren't interested in it, but because you had been convinced that you weren't good at it.
I was so bad at it, or at least I thought I was so bad at it. And I guess that's the same thing. It's a little bit of the same thing. I failed or nearly failed almost every science class that I ever took. I remember really hating going to my science classes when I was in high school because I was really bad at memorization. And a lot of science at first is just learning the names of things and being able to identify them. And I was really bad at those sorts of things. So I couldn't remember the bones in the human body or the elements in the periodic table. And as a result, I got really bad grades in high school. And I thought, okay, well, that's something that I'm interested in, but I'm not good at. And that's okay. I will go on to other things.
The public school system is not set up for people who aren't good at memorization. It is not.
I think no school system is good. You're right. Like, I mean, like, it's just not. Look, you need to know. Look, we had to, at some point, you and I had to memorize the letters of the alphabet, right? If not for that, we would not be able to read. And so, like, there is some logic in teaching people the names of things, right? This is how we build knowledge. But if you're bad at that, and if it doesn't go at your own pace, then you're kind of out of luck. And I was a little bit out of luck for that. Now, the good news is, a super privileged person, I had lots of options for doing other things with my life. I ended up going into the Navy, and then I went back to school, and I became a journalist and a newspaper reporter and a radio host. But I always was in love with science. I didn't fall out of love with the idea, with the awe of science. And so I just figured that I wasn't going to be a scientist myself. I totally put that out of any consideration whatsoever.
And it was what would later become a chapter in your 2019 book, Superlative, which, how cool is it to say you're an author? But it was in that in that introductory chapter in your 2019 book that you officially started to turn into a science writer.
Yeah. I mean, what happened is that I woke up one day and I had this thought in my mind. And the thought was, like, what is the oldest thing in the world? And the great news about living in this magical modern age that we live in is that you can generally answer questions like that, right? You roll over, you open up your laptop computer, and you ask the internet. And so I did. I asked the internet, you know, what is the oldest living thing on Earth? And you know, in my slightly sleep-addled mind, I was like, it's like a tortoise or something. And I wasn't even, I was totally thinking about animals. I wasn't even thinking about plants. And of course, like, plants often live much longer than animals. But, like, what plant, right? And it turns out that one of the contenders for this title, scientists aren't really exactly sure, but one of the contenders for this title is an aspen clone that lives in central Utah, just a couple of hours south of my home, that has this interconnected root system. And in order for it to grow as big as it has grown, it is more than 100 acres. It has to be very, very old. And scientists aren't really sure how old, but some of the estimates say tens of thousands of years, which puts it in contention for the oldest thing on Earth. And also, as it happens, puts it into contention for the largest thing on Earth. And I got so fascinated with this, and I went down and I visited it with a scientist from Utah State University who has been a guest on our program a couple of times, Paul Rogers. He introduced me to this aspen clone Pando. And I also learned from Paul that it was dying. And I thought, wow, like, as a journalist, what a great story. So that's the story I started to write. And that's sort of my first foray into science reporting.
And at that point, did you realize, like, as you were writing that story, did you have any idea how much that would transform your career, how much it would change your trajectory? This passion that you'd had but didn't feel like was in the cards for you was suddenly on the table again.
No, because honestly, I just looked at it as another story, right? Like, I do this a lot. I get interested in things that I don't know anything about, and then I find somebody to pay me a little money to write about them for their publication, and, you know, that's that. And so that's sort of what journalists do all the time. So I didn't really see that as doing anything different, and I didn't connect it to, you know, the struggles that I had had as a science learner growing up. It was just another assignment. But then what happened, Reagan, is that I got this call one day and somebody, the woman at the end of the other end of the line said, hey, congratulations, you've won a Kavli Science Journalism Award, which is one of the largest awards for science writing in the country. So I get to fly out to San Jose for the AAAS conference. That's the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. I think I got that right. And then one of the judges from the contest, Laura Hellmuth, who was the science editor at the time of Slate, and I think she's still at the Washington Post now, came up to me and she said, this idea of writing about superlative things would make a really great book. Have you thought about that? And no, I had not thought about that at all, but then I was. Then I thought, wow, oh my God, it is such a great concept. And so I spent several years after that flying around the world chasing things that are really big or really fast or really old or really strong or really whatever, superlative phenomena in our natural world. And that's really when I realized that, like, hey, actually, this is something I can do. And I can actually focus on science, even though I wasn't good at being a scientist.
So you are writing about science, you're writing about all of these great ideas, you have all of these great opportunities, and then at some point, something happens, and you're the scientist. And that's why you're here as a guest, and I'm interviewing you. But at what point did that switch take place? When did you sit down and publish your first piece of research as a scientist?
What happened is I was having coffee with a really good friend of mine, Simon Wong, who started at Utah State University at the same time that I did as a professor. I was a professor of journalism. He was a professor of climate science. And we were chatting and he was asking me about, like, what are you going to be doing for the next few years of your life? And I said, oh, you know what? I've been kind of thinking about going back to school and getting a PhD because I'm this really weird thing. I'm a tenured professor at a major university, but I don't have a PhD. I just have a lot of experience in journalism and then a master's degree in education. I'd like to finally go back to school and get a PhD. And he said, oh, cool. In what? And I said, I don't know, something like journalism adjacent, like political science, maybe history. I don't know, something like that. And he goes, bah. And I'm like, wait, what? And he says, why don't you study climate science? And this thought has never occurred to me, right? Like, studying science as a PhD student didn't occur to me, but studying climate science certainly didn't occur to me. You know, the idea was, I got to be honest, like, at first, not even intriguing. And I go, you know, I was like, haha, that really actually sounds hard. And he scoffed at me again and he goes, oh, it sounds hard, does it? Aren't you the professor who's always complaining that his students don't want to work hard?
Yeah, that's brutal. And it's so right.
I know. What a jerk, right? And so then I puff up my chest and I go, well, fine, I will be.
You decided to get a doctorate out of spite.
I did. I decided to get a doctorate out of spite. And then I regretted it for like 2 years after that. For 2 years after that, I was constantly like, why did I do that? Why did I let Simon goad me into that? Simon, by the way, mensch all the way through. Every time, all during those 2 years where I was like, this was a dumb decision, he was like, I got you, man. It's going to be okay. And eventually it was. And then I started getting invited to co-author research papers. At first, not because I was a good climate scientist. At first, because I was a good writer. So it's like, oh, we got the writing guy now who knows a little bit about climate science. Let's bring him on. And so I got invited onto a paper about the intensification of the East Asian summer monsoon and a model that shows, you know, how it will intensify under climate warming. And then I got invited onto a paper that would examine cloud seeding conditions, the conditions under which that we can like shoot things into a cloud and make it rain a little more in the mountains here in Utah. And then it just started like progressing and progressing. And I got invited onto more papers. And every time I got invited onto another paper, I learned a little bit more until, you know, one day I was like, hey, you know what? Like, I could actually do this myself too. I can come up with an idea. I can lead a paper. I can do the examination.
You published a paper in 2022 in April. So that's about 6 months before the great snowpocalypse that I mentioned earlier happened that winter. And that research talked about what you called miracle events in the Colorado River Basin area. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, although there is a distinction that needs to be made here is that what we were looking at are these springtime miracle events. So these events that come after, you know, we've historically seen them. You can go back into like newspaper archives and you can see, you know, people in the Colorado River Basin talking about droughts, like long-term droughts being busted because all of a sudden there was this deluge in the Colorado River Basin. And it just rained really, really hard all at once. And that busted up the drought, which is, you know, that's a really great thing to happen. I mean, you can't rely on it happening every year. It doesn't even happen every few years. But it was, you know, this thing that, you know, farmers are always praying for rain, right? And one of the things that this big team, there's like 20 authors on this thing, this big team investigated was what will happen under climate warming, under different climate warming scenarios, depending on if we're, you know, a few degrees higher or a few more than that or a few more than that. What will happen to these events? Will they go away? Will they happen more frequently? And what we learned is that they are very likely to become less frequent, which means instead of these miracle events that wash away the drought happening, say, like every 7 or 8 or 9 years, we're talking about every 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 years. So they could become less frequent, but they'll probably drop more water when they come. And this is related to something that we're seeing all across the atmosphere right now, which is this intensification of things that happen. So all across the West, we're seeing an intensification of drought. But at the same time, we're also seeing an intensification of precipitation. Like, you go like, how can that be, right? We're going to have longer droughts, right? Intensified droughts, longer and hotter droughts. But then also when it does rain, maybe less frequently, it's also going to be more intense. That's really bad for agriculture, by the way. What you want is like steady precipitation, predictable precipitation, and not drought, right? Not drought is a bad thing for agriculture, as it turns out.
And so this inconsistency, am I correct to assume this planted a question in your mind about, is there any way to predict when these different extremes will come?
Oh, so that's a really good question. I think perhaps it was in the back of my mind as a result of being part of that research paper, that when this snowpocalypse happened, this huge snow that you talked about at the beginning of the episode, where we just got deluged. I live in Big Cottonwood Canyon outside of Salt Lake City. We got 850 inches of snow at my house in a year. I was very happy to see it, but it was so much snow that it was, you know, sinking in people's decks and their roofs. And, you know, we didn't have, in my neighborhood, we have a guy, Paul, comes by and he plows the road. He ran out of places to put the snow because the snow banks were so tall.
No, it felt like nothing I'd ever seen before. It was so cold too, and it was just every day I expected it to stop, and it never stopped. And so I imagine something as intense as that, after having studied these intense periods of drought and then rain and just the back and forth, having something so intense probably planted something of a seed that led into the study that we're here to talk about today. And it ultimately led you to the Colorado River Basin. Will you tell me a little bit about why you decided to really hone in on the Colorado River Basin?
Well, initially, I was just looking at Salt Lake. I was thinking very much of myself. I was like, hey, can we predict years like this so I know when to like quit my job and only ski for a winter? And that, like, really, that was the nugget, right? And so, you know, like, I know as a climate scientist, as most climate scientists and many people who aren't climate scientists know, there are some very robust connections between variations in sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific and the kinds of weather regimes that we get in different parts of North America. And these are quite predictable in certain areas of the country, right? Phases of El Nino and La Nina affect the Southwest and affect the Pacific Northwest in pretty predictable ways. There's always been this question about whether or not these phases actually affect this liminal area, sort of between the Pacific Northwest and between the Southwest, right? And this, you know, this band that goes from Northern California to Northern Nevada to Utah to Colorado to Kansas, right? What we've also known is sometimes those effects from the south can be pushed north, or those effects from the north can be pushed south and start to impact this liminal band. So then the logical question to ask was, is that what happened this year? Is that why we got a snowpocalypse? Because of some specific pattern of sea surface temperature warming or cooling, and then its resultant effects on the atmosphere gave us what we ended up getting in the Great Salt Lake Basin. So what we realized also is that, hey, there have been, for a longer period of time, there's been much more observations in the Great Salt Lake Basin, but we've got really, really robust data from the last like 90 years. And so we said, okay, let's use that. Let's see if that data helps us understand what's happening in the Colorado River Basin since observations have gotten more frequent there. Sure enough, there's a very high correlation. And then using a couple of little tricks of math, we said, okay, we're going to use the Great Salt Lake as a proxy for the Upper Colorado River Basin. The reason that's important is because the Great Salt Lake Basin, it's what they call endorheic, right? It is a closed basin. Water goes to the Great Salt Lake. It doesn't go anywhere else after that. But the Upper Colorado River Basin supplies water for tens of millions of people downstream. So we said, hey, look, we can use what's happening, you know, in this year to predict what will happen in the Colorado River Basin. And then we can use that to better understand these cycles and these connections, these what we call in climate science teleconnections. Was there a connection between, for instance, variations in sea surface temperatures of the tropical Pacific and what we saw in this big snow year?
But what you found out is that wasn't really the case. There was very little correlation with the El Nino, correct?
This is what we call wah-wah-wah science. And this is the point that I went to my advisor and I said, yeah, look, I have pulled the records. I have looked at the patterns. And look, we can't find any correlation between what happened here and patterns of warming and cooling in the Pacific Ocean that would give us an explanation for why we had so much snow. Oh, shoot, we're out of luck. And he goes, no, man, you got to think about this in a different way. First of all, it's really important as scientists that we're not just saying what we know, but what we don't know. Because you're looking at this now, And other scientists are likely to ask this question too. So let's try to publish on that. It's not going to be like, this is not going to be a barnstorming, you know, jaw-dropping scientific discovery. We looked, we didn't find something. Doesn't, you know, sell many newspapers.
But this also opened a door. So ultimately what you found was that although climate change might make rainfall more erratic, and although El Nino sometimes plays a role, there's also these random other factors that do. And that can have bigger implications, and that can help us understand that we can't rely solely on those things that we tend to fall back on.
Yeah, I think what we said is, look, if this year could be so intense, get so much snow, and we still can't find a causal explanation for teleconnection that exists that helps explain why we got so much snow in one year, then maybe what we need to do is take our eye off of that problem and look more broadly. And so we looked at patterns of drought and pluvial years, right? Very rainy years. And we found this very distinct kind of cycle of 11 to 17 years, what we call a quasi-decadal pattern of climate variability, where you get wet for 12 to 17 years, and then you get dry for 12 to 17 years, and then wet, and then dry, and then wet, and then dry. And the way that Simon Wong has explained this is the benefit of knowing this, of knowing that there's going to be a lot of variability, and you can't predict how much water you're going to have year to year in this interannual way in the Upper Colorado River Basin, is it's a little bit like playing the stock market, right? Like, anybody who invests in stocks will tell you, like, you don't pick a stock on a Monday thinking that it's going to increase in value on a Tuesday so that you can sell it on a Tuesday. What you do is you look at long-term trends. You say, this is going to become more valuable in a stable way over time. And similarly, what this research suggests is that we may never be able to, even in the case of extreme years, we may never be able to predict when a big year is going to happen. And so if we can't do that in an interannual way, right, from year to year, predict when water is going to be coming in a crazy way like it did two winters ago or not, then perhaps what we need to do is really focus our attention on these longer-term multi-decadal cycles, these longer-term ebbs and flows, and let those inform the way that we use water and the way that we plan over time.
And what does that look like? What are the suggestions for how we plan and how we use that water?
So one good example of this is that after this really big snowpocalyptic winter, a lot of smaller reservoirs all across the West were really full. And the impulse might be, hey, you know what? We got all this water. Let's let it go downstream. Let's make sure that like farmers get a little extra this year. Let's make sure that municipalities get a little extra this year. And water managers all across the West said, you know what? Maybe not. Maybe let's hold on to this stuff. Let's keep this money in the bank because we don't know what's coming. And this was, this was before this study, but, they already knew, like, you know what? We don't know for sure that we're going to get this opportunity again. So let's be very cautious. So I think one of the things it looks like is just the thing that we all sort of intuitively know, we are going to have to be more careful about water. But, and here's the but, let's say that we're, you know, 2, 3, 4 years into one of these cycles. That gives us just another thing that we can use. It gives water managers just another thing that they can use to make their decisions. And it's not going to change everything. They're not going to completely change their behavior. But if they know that they're in a pluvial cycle, a rainy cycle, they're likely to let a little bit more water downstream. They're likely to share a little bit more. They're likely to wheel and deal a little bit more. And if they know that they're in a drier cycle, one of these drier 12 to 17 year old cycles, same difference, right? Or the opposite, I should say. They're likely to be a little bit more stingy about how much they let go, about how much they let out of the reservoirs. That's just one example, but it's one of the ways that we can use science to incrementally change our decision making, right? If you are trading stocks, you don't need to know all of the information. But if you've got a little bit more information, you have a big advantage in the long term.
That's Matthew LaPlante. Matthew is the host and founder of Undisciplined, an author, a journalist, a climate scientist, and an associate professor of journalistic writing at Utah State University. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you, Reagan. Wow, that was weird. I'm ready to be back in your seat next week.
We can switch places again soon.
Sounds good.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Science at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. I'm your producer, Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and that was Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.